In The Wretched of the Earth, Fanon writes, "The well-being and progress of Europe have been built up with the sweat and dead bodies of Negroes, Arabs, Indians, and the yellow races." The Marxist scholar Walter Rodney makes the same point in How Europe Underdeveloped Africa. Anti-colonialist writers insist that the former colonized countries are poor because the West is rich. The West, they say, became rich by looting the wealth and resources of other countries. A fourth tenet of anti-colonialism is that the colonial powers have a new leader, the United States. As Said puts it, the United States has replaced the great earlier empires and is the dominant outside force. Lest you naively think that America was not a colonial power and does not have a history of oppression like Britain or France, historians Michael Omi and Howard Winant draw our attention to what has happened within America. The broad sweep of U.S. history is characterized not by racial democracy, but by racial despotism, not by trajectories of reform, but by implacable denial of political rights, dehumanization, extreme exploitation, and policies of minority extirpation. Omi and Winant are referring to the displacement of Native Indians, the seizure and occupation of their territory, the ideology of manifest destiny, the war with Mexico and the capture of large tracts of Mexican land, and the annexation of Hawaii, all aimed at expanding the settlement we now call the United States. Anti-colonial critics also point to the 1823 promulgation of the Monroe Doctrine, in which America basically declared that Central and South America were our sphere of influence, telling the European powers to stay out of our neighborhood. In the 20th century, the United States routinely intervened in Central and South America to protect U.S. political interests, and also in the interests of U.S. corporations, such as the United Fruit Company. Anti-colonialists also highlight America's 50-year imperial adventure in the Philippines, which was short-lived by European standards, but by itself discredits any attempt to declare America innocent of participation in colonial escapades. And today? Well, anti-colonial critics say that the problem is worse than ever. While America's global dominance has been evident since World War II, it has only increased with the end of the Cold War and the disappearance of the Soviet Union as a serious rival. So now America has the power and uses it to subjugate other countries and bring them under the American jackboot. Sometimes this is outright colonial occupation, as when American troops invade and occupy another country, such as Afghanistan or Iraq, but mostly America exercises its domination through political and economic strong-arm tactics. The effect is the same as what the Europeans once did. America uses its might to plunder the land and resources of the world, leaving behind a trail of dead and destitute non-white peoples. This brings us to the fifth and final tenet of anti-colonialism, which is that there is no end to this system of injustice without getting the colonizers out. This may occur peacefully, or it may require violence, but either way, it must occur. Fanon calls this total liberation. But total liberation is not limited to taking down the foreign flags and sending the men in military uniforms home. Rather, it also requires purging the colonies of the enduring political and economic influence of colonialism. Here we have the crucial idea that colonialism does not necessarily end with national independence. Instead, anti-colonialists say, it can continue in subtle but powerful forms to dominate the life of supposedly free nations. Of the Western powers, Chinwezu writes, "Even now, the fury of their expansionist assault upon the rest of us has not abated." The Indian social critic Gayatri Chakravorty deplores what she considers to be the continuing success of the imperialist project. The idea that colonialism continues even after countries officially declare independence is called neo-colonialism. In his book Neo-Colonialism, The Last Stage of Imperialism, Kwame Nkrumah, who became the first president of independent Ghana, argues that Africa's freedom was freedom only in name. That's because In reality, its economic system and its political policy is directed from outside. Nkrumah points to powerful Western corporations and other forces that, like puppet masters, manipulate Africa's destiny. For Nkrumah, there is only one way to fight back: socialism. Nkrumah insists that state socialism on the part of the newly independent peoples can effectively stop the new threat posed by neocolonialism. Why is socialism the solution? How specifically are socialism and Marxism connected with anti-colonialism? Many people are surprised to discover that Marx was actually a defender of colonialism. He argued that it brought primitive societies into modernity and laid the foundation for industrialization and eventually communism. Marx predicted, however, that communist revolution would occur first in the industrialized nations of Europe. That didn't happen, and it was a serious problem for Marxists. In the beginning of the 20th century, an English author, J.A. Hobson, formulated the ingenious thesis that the Western capitalist countries had delayed their internal economic crisis by invading foreign countries and pirating their wealth. In effect, European colonialism was the way to postpone European capitalism's day of reckoning. In 1916, Lenin reformulated Hobson's thesis in his well-known tract, Imperialism, the Highest Stage of Capitalism. As Lenin succinctly put it, capitalism has been transformed into imperialism. Notice the similarity between the titles used by Lenin and Nkrumah. Many anti-colonial leaders like Nkrumah embraced Lenin's analysis and became lifelong socialists. Many of them didn't even read Marx, but socialism was a way to position themselves against what they perceived to be an oppressive alliance between imperialism and capitalism. One of these anti-colonialists was Barack Obama, Sr. Obama became an important figure in the Kenyan independence movement, but his greatest influence was not in Kenya. Rather, through an incredible osmosis, he was able to transmit his ideology to his son living in America. That man is today the President of the United States. My argument in this book is that it is the anti-colonial ideology of his African father that Barack Obama took to heart. From a very young age and throughout his formative years, Obama learned to see America as a force for global domination and destruction. He came to see America's military as an instrument of neo-colonial occupation. He adopted his father's position that the free market is a code word for economic plunder. Obama grew to perceive the rich as an oppressive class, a kind of neo-colonial power within America. He began to detest corporations as institutional mechanisms for economic control and exploitation. In Obama's worldview, profits are a measure of how effectively you have ripped off the rest of society, and America's power in the world is a measure of how selfishly it consumes the globe's resources and how ruthlessly it bullies and dominates the rest of the planet. For Obama, the task ahead is simple. He must work to wring the neo-colonialism out of America and the West. First, he must rein in the military so that it does not conduct wars of occupation against other countries. Then he must use American leverage to restrict military adventurism on the part of America's allies, especially the former colonial powers in Europe. Even symbolic measures of humiliation are helpful in showing the former European colonialists that their day is now gone. In addition, Obama seeks to check American and Western consumption of global resources so that the former colonial and now neo-colonial powers do not consume what belongs to others. Another objective for Obama is to bring the powerful sectors of American industry, such as the investment banks and healthcare, under government supervision and control. Obama seeks a large custodial state as a protection against the dangers of concentrated corporate power. Finally, Obama seeks to castigate and expose the rich, who are viewed as a neo-colonial force within American society, so that they cease to be exploiters of the rest of the population. It may seem shocking to suggest that this is Obama's core ideology and that he believes it still. That is what I am saying. I am not suggesting that Obama has a comprehensive knowledge of anti-colonialism. A whole body of anti-colonial scholarship associated with such names as Mario Vargas Llosa, Octavio Paz, V.S. Naipaul, and Derek Walcott seems unknown to him. Nor am I implying that anti-colonial views are the only determinants of Obama's beliefs. Certainly, I admit that Obama must occasionally and pragmatically bend to the realities of a given situation or to the exigencies of politics. Still, Obama's anti-colonialism is deeply felt, and it suffuses his writings and speeches. In fact, it is the moral and intellectual foundation of his ideology. In a sense, I am saying nothing more than what Obama himself says, that his father's dream has become his dream. It is a dream that, as president, he is imposing with a vengeance on America and the world. This audiobook is continued on Disc 2.